Broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. The Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Previously recorded with Mark as the host of The Mark Kohler Show.
Enjoy this fresh take on strategies to better live the American dream.
Everybody to a beautiful fall radio show. Happy Thanksgiving, and welcome to another episode of the Mark Kohler Show. I'm here, yours truly, talking about building wealth, saving taxes, protecting our assets, making more money, just trying to relieve a little bit more stress in our lives with that huge financial burden of making things all work in our lives. Isn't it tough? It is tough sometimes, but that's okay. We've got answers. We've got ideas. We've got thoughts and comments and wonderful suggestions from our many listeners and guests we have on a regular basis on the show. So welcome. If you're a new listener, we're glad to have you here. We've got a wonderful show planned today. This is broadcasting live. We've got three guests that will be calling in here shortly, and we're going to be talking about lending issues today. How do I find the best loans for my real estate deals, best interest rates, and the best lenders? How do I find them? Well, we're going to bring on some experts here and do a panel as we get closer to the bottom of the hour. And I think many of you will find it helpful. I'm actually anxious, very anxious, to get some answers. It's very tough to find good lending. It's just very hard. So we're going to be beating that up and hopefully sharing some great tips and strategies with you. Happy Thanksgiving, like I said. This is Thanksgiving week. Some of you may have thought, is Mark really holding the radio show? We've had an email server problem this morning, and this is the first time in almost 5 years an email did not go out on Tuesday morning. So many of you probably were looking for that email to listen to the show, and now you're catching it recorded. So I want to say thank you for Kevin back on the link catching this, and hopefully over the holidays some of you might be catching up on some shows and listening to a podcast while you're exercising, jogging, enjoying a drive, maybe driving over the holidays. You're picking up some podcasts here, so hopefully you're listening while you're on the road, and drive safe. So from the tax tip side, I'm really anxious to talk about some year-end tax strategies. So I want to hit several important deadlines. Now, those of you that are listening to this show, maybe in the spring or later down the road, hey, these are still good tips, no matter what. But I'm just going to put some deadlines on it here for those of you listening here in November and December, because it's kind of a big deal. But before we get to the tax tips, we've got one of our regular experts that comes on the show and shares some legal tips and strategies with us. We've got Jerem Bergeson, and I want to bring him out to the show. Jerem, welcome.
How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing great. And I know I typically do a little bit more of an intro going over the deadlines for the week or the month, but since I'm going to be covering that from a tax angle here in a moment, I thought I'd talk legal with you for a minute. What do you got for us? Did you have some legal tips or advice for us this week doing your consultations?
Well, my main tip for this week is to make sure you don't skip breakfast on Thanksgiving morning. You want to have that breakfast in you so that your stomach doesn't shrink, so you can maximize your food intake for Thanksgiving dinner later in the day.
Oh, is that that's a real strategy, huh?
that's where my mind is actually today. But no, I do have a legal tip.
Okay.
As you probably know, or you do know, I was traveling around last week around the state of Utah doing some speaking engagements, channeling my inner Mark Kohler, and speaking in a few locations in front of some farmers and ranchers. About estate planning, getting wills and trusts done and making sure that you're structured properly to save on taxes now and possibly on estate taxes down the road, and making sure you're avoiding probate on your assets and all that kind of stuff. And so I was doing those speaking engagements last week, and one of the folks in the audience raised their hand while I was speaking, and she said, it was an older couple, and it was the wife, and she raised her hand, and she said, "Well, you know what? Me and my husband, we just can't agree. We can't agree on what to do. We can't agree on who to leave the assets to and how to leave them." And Liddell, your partner in the accounting firm that was with me, he had a really interesting comment back. He said, "Well, by doing nothing, you are agreeing. You're agreeing to do nothing. You're agreeing to have the state step in and decide who's going to be getting your assets. You've made that agreement by failing to come to an agreement." And I think that just made a lot of sense. That if you do nothing with your estate plan because you can't agree with your spouse, then you are agreeing. You're agreeing to let the state decide on a lot of these issues and agreeing and to kind of let chaos reign in some ways when you pass away.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. I would have wise phrase to use in that situation. So I think that's a really interesting point. And many of you, the government should know, the government has planned for this contingency with all sorts of estate, or it's typically in what's called the probate code for the state laws that explain what happens if someone doesn't decide and make a decision, and then your assets are split up in unique ways, and kids are going to be 18 and get it, and it may not be the best fit for them or for the best use of the assets. So we got to be careful there. No, excellent point. So good stuff.
Yeah, even that's exactly right. Even if you don't plan, even if you don't have an estate plan, the state's got an estate plan for you, and you may not like it. It may not be what you would have done. But there, if you do nothing, the state steps in, and they've done your planning for you. And if you don't want to go with what they've planned for you, then that's where you need to be proactive and get this, get an estate plan in place, have a will, possibly a trust, and other documents that are important for those end-of-life decisions and issues.
I love it. Very, very good points. Well, I know estate planning has been on your mind a lot the last few weeks as you were traveling around the country teaching farmers about their farm and estate plans. And farmers think about that. They're out on the land going, who's going to inherit my land? And it's a neat feeling. I know many of you out there that have that special ranch or cabin or farm or a second home, a little beach house, a little mountain cabin, and you want to make sure it stays in the family for years and years, and you leave some sort of legacy, and that can be planned for very carefully and very easily, actually, with sometimes a family limited partnership or a trust structure. So leaving a legacy is something that maybe it's ingrained in us. We want to leave something behind, I think. But well, Jerem, thanks so much for coming on the show. Great, good stuff.
Thanks.
Great tip. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Appreciate you having me.
You bet. And enjoy that football, too. We know you're a big football fan, so enjoy your holiday week.
Will do. You too.
Okay, thanks. All right. Well, folks, I want to jump into five tips. Now, this is going to be, I think, really powerful. I think these are some of the hottest tips that I have in my arsenal. These are all comments that I talk about in depth in my book, What Your CPA Isn't Telling You, and they're really important for timing reasons. So I want to hit these five different little tips right now, and again, you could implement these at any time during the year, but we are coming up with some deadlines here in November and December. So the first one, which you've seen on the newsletter the last couple weeks, is the health savings account. And I was giving our Orange County workshop on Saturday, and one of the students came up and said, Mark, I got to set up my HSA by December 1st or I'm not going to be able to do it. Now, here's an important point. Listen up, folks, please. You don't have to have an HSA set up by December 1st. You can fund an HSA all the way up until April and get a tax deduction for this year. That's about $3,000 for an individual, $6,000 for a couple. It's pretty sweet, right on the front page of your tax return. No phase outs, no income limitations, and the money grows tax-free, comes out tax-free for your health care. These HSAs are just amazing. They're like a supercharged IRA for health care. But the rule is, by December 1st, you have to have a high-deductible health insurance plan, a health insurance plan that allows for an HSA contribution, which is typically a deductible of around $1,200 if you're single, $3,000 if you're a family. Now, under the new healthcare exchanges, this is going to be one of those bronze plans. And when you get into healthcare.gov or your state exchange, you can search for that or just call an independent health insurance agent and say, I want an HSA qualifying plan. And as many of you know, I've said it time and time again, if you're generally healthy, why not get the higher deductible and self-insure yourself? So if you're healthy and you rarely go to the doctor, put that money away for the day you're going to need the money, whether it's for eyes or dental or chiropractic or something like that. You can pull out the money and take a tax deduction now and take that money out tax-free later. Folks, there will be a day when you need health care. So that's tip number one. Don't worry about setting up the HSA before December 1st. Just get your insurance converted to the right type of plan by December 1st, which is about a week and a half away from right now listening live. Number two, there's another deadline here that's important, and that's December 31st for paying family members. As you know, many of you that have listened to my show at all or been to a workshop or read my book know that I think one of the best tax strategies out there and life strategies is teaching your kids about entrepreneurship and small business and getting your family on payroll. Now, this could include an adult child, an adult parent, nieces, nephews, grandkids. Now, I'm not going to get into detail. That's something for the book, and I've got webinars on this, and you guys can study up more and get a personal consult with one of our CPAs at the office for just a few minutes, and you'll understand what you need to do in the details. But here's the point. You can't just say next April when you file your tax return that I paid my kids. You can't say, oh, I paid my kids, I get a write-off. You actually have to go through the process. So before December 31st, in the next 5 weeks, even if your kids have been helping you all year long, your little 5-year-old, your 15-year-old, your 55-year-old, doesn't matter, either you're going to 1099 them or you're going to do a W-2 or you're going to do nothing at all, depending on the rules. And we could talk about that in detail and individually or, again, study up a little on it. But the point is you have to transfer the money to them. You have to show the paper trail. So if you can run the money through their account, reimburse yourself. Put the money there, turn around and reimburse yourself for paying for other things of theirs during the year. But make sure they're involved, they understand what's going on, that they actually have done services they deserve to get paid for, and it's phenomenal. And you can do it all at once. There was a person that came up to to me on Saturday with the workshop too and said, hey, Mark, don't I have to pay my kids every week or every month? Do I have to have a time card? I said, no. You can pay them all at once at the end of the year, but you need to be able to show a record of what they did throughout the year to earn it. I've talked to many, many IRS agents throughout the years that have no problem at all with this strategy. And it's not a highly audited issue. It's very rare. So get on it. So that's strategy number two. Before year end, make sure that you've got your family members paid for their services they provide during the year. Okay, strategy number three, the 401k strategy. Now, let me point this out. Some of you, come April, are going to say, Mark, I want to save taxes. What can I do? Well, in April, it could be too late. Next summer, you're going to be asking me this. I know some of you on the show right now are listening going, Mark, I want to save taxes for last year. Well, the time to save taxes for last year is in November and December doing some year-end planning. Now, for some of you that are having a good year, you've made some money with some extra projects or some extra revenue in a different small business arrangement or something like that. You've made a little extra money, and that money's sitting in your bank account. Let's move it over to a 401k. The 401k is like, oh my gosh, how can I express this? It's like the Ferrari of retirement plans. It's so efficient, it's fast, it's economical. They're just boom. I mean, they're just perfect. Now, if you want to just put a few dollars away, You can do an IRA in the spring. That's fine. We can even use a SEP or a simple later on. Just kind of throw some money in there, maybe $5,000 or $10,000 between you and your spouse, or just you. I mean, if you want to just put away a few bucks, an IRA could just be perfect for you. But for those of you, now here's my tip. For those of you that are able and willing to put away $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 or more, and you want to get some real retirement money growing, maybe even self-directed, put it in the market, whatever, you've got to form the 401k mid-December. By mid-December, that 401k documentation has got to be signed and filed. In it, you can. There's different companies that'll push the envelope a little further than others, but you got to be on that 401k process in mid-December. Now, one of our guests today, Randy Lubke, who I'll be introducing here shortly, he's one of our experts in the Southern California area, helping clients, frankly, all over the country at times. So find a resource. He's one we trust. We love him. And there's other people out there that certainly in your local area, and we can send you other references. But get a 401k started if you want to put the money in there, because you can't do this later on next year. So that's strategy three. Now, folks, if you just joined us, we're going through 5 year-end tips that have got to be considered or you're not going to get to use them. So number one was funneling money into a health savings account, which requires a high-deductible health insurance plan by December 1st. Number two, paying your family members, funneling them the money, and then we'll worry about a 1099 or the reporting process. Do a little research on that and get a consult. And number three, the 401k. Number four, for those of you that have an S corporation, this month, November, December, is absolutely critical to decide on how much payroll you're going to take. Now, it's a function of how much money you made this year. Now, for some of you that are like, Mark, I didn't do an S-Corp this year. I've just got a sole proprietor. I'm not making a lot of money right now. I'm just launching my business. Fine. Don't worry about the payroll thing. But if you have an S-Corporation, what you've got to decide, are you going to take zero payroll or $50,000 in payroll or $100,000 in payroll? What is it? And it's going to be a function of your income, your net income. Now, some of you, you know, you've seen my diagrams on my blog and in my workshop. It's called the Kohler Payroll Matrix. It's ingenious. You would love it. The Kohler Payroll Matrix, where I set up a diagram where you can plug, kind of by looking at your income and where you need to be, where your payroll can function. Now, this is a great strategy for payroll planning to find a safe harbor. So if some of you that want to do the least amount of payroll to just do your fair share so the IRS doesn't audit you, my matrix will tell you where to be. For those of you that want to put more money in a 401k or do some other strategies, then we're going to nail that. We want to talk about it. So in the next 5 weeks, get with your CPA advisor, your PTC, we call them your personal tax consultant at our office, or whoever you're using, your payroll clerk, ADP, you're using Costco, I don't know. Whoever you're doing, you've got to address your payroll before year end. That's number four. Now, our fifth tip before we move on to the topic of the hour, number five, year-end tax strategy is potentially a Roth conversion. Now, this is a great strategy for some of you that have the financial wherewithal where you've got an IRA laying around or an old 401k, you want to roll out some of it to an IRA. You can do a Roth conversion before year end. Then, here's the cool part, folks. Well, let me summarize this. When you do a Roth conversion, you're going to pay the tax now on your IRA, and then the money will continue to grow tax-free and come out tax-free in the future. Those Roths are amazing. But you want to look at what's your income tax bracket this year, how much tax can you afford to pay, do you want to just convert $1,000 or $5,000 or $50,000 or $500,000, I don't know. You can convert whatever dollar amount you want, pay the tax now. But the catch here is, and this is the cool part, if by April 15th you say, I changed my mind, I don't want to pay the tax, forget it, I want out, I don't want to do the Roth conversion, you simply file another form and you get out of jail free. That's it. So you've got this free pass. But if by December 31st you don't make the Roth conversion paperwork, fill it out and file it, then you can't do the Roth conversion. You've got to file that paperwork by the end of the year. So that's another major deadline where we can't play around with it in the spring. So, folks, these are just five. I recorded a webinar last week on our Strategic Wealth Alliance where I went through a whole hour on my computer screen with 11 year-end strategies. Here's just five. If some of you want to catch that webinar series, go purchase the Strategic Wealth Alliance. It's on my website, markjkohler.com. Get a consultation with our personal tax consultant. Get out and Google and study. I'm going to be doing some blog articles over the next 5 weeks with year-end tips. But these are great little things that can save you thousands. So there you go, folks. Another hopefully powerful few minutes here on the Mark Kohler Show, and I hope that you're having a good note-taking experience. So think about it. I'm hoping those can help you out. Okay, now I'm anxious to introduce and talk with some of our guests here today. This is an exciting episode for me, and I've been wanting actually to do this show for a while, and I'm really grateful for the group that we have on here. So I want to do three introductions here on these folks, and this is a neat opportunity for me because these are people I really trust, and I'm grateful again that they're here. So we're going to be talking about lending, and the first topic, the first person I want to introduce here is Matt Allen. Now he's a author of a book, IRA Lending. He's been on my show many times before. I've spoken on stage with him, and Matt Allen is a lender specifically for IRAs, 401ks, and he's travels around the country helping people get loans for their retirement accounts. Now, before we jump into our other guests, who I mentioned, Randy Lubke, Aaron Chapman, we're going to be coming back to those guys here in a moment on general, just a huge host of different type of lending. But first, I wanted to bring Matt out and talk about some of this IRA lending and just get this topic dealt with it right off the bat. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you bet. And I appreciate you finding time. I know it's sometimes short notice with me, and we're just grateful to have you here on the show. You do such a good job. So Matt, tell me, first of all, some of the big myths out there, and I guess secrets, or people don't know didn't know that when they're going out to find real estate projects, they might actually be able to use their retirement account. Tell us how this works. Tell us a little bit about this strategy.
Sure. Well, the IRS actually allows investors to purchase investment real estate within the retirement plan. So any plan that is self-directed has that opportunity. When I say self-directed, I mean a truly self-directed account, not a self-directed plan with, say, Schwab or Merrill Lynch, where they allow you to self-direct the investment choices within their portfolio, so stocks, bonds, mutual funds. So if you set up an account with a truly self-directed company, again, you can purchase investment in real estate. So all the money that you're going to earn from your tenant on a monthly basis will grow tax-free or tax-deferred. And then also, when you sell that property, any net profit you receive will actually roll back into that account too. So that can be very powerful for your retirement plan. Instead of growing it with your traditional assets, you know, you have the opportunity to invest with real estate. And if that's something you know and understand, that might be a good option for you. The second piece that even more people don't know about is you can actually get a loan to purchase the real estate. So if you don't have, say, $100,000 for a single-family home you want to buy, but you only have $60,000 in your IRA, well, you can actually leverage, say, 50% of that purchase. So you're putting $50,000 down. Then the other $50,000, a non-recourse lender would provide that remaining $50,000 balance.
Well, you hit one of the key questions I wanted to ask, and that is, if you're going to use an IRA or 401k to buy real estate, you've just set it 50%. And I understand that, Matt, you usually want about 40% down for the actual purchase and about a 10% reserve, so that way you've got a little bit of safety there. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that would be accurate. Our average loan to value, LTV, is around 60%. We'll go up to 70% in some cases on single family homes, but most investors are putting at least 40% down. As far as reserves, you know, you hit on a very important piece. When you buy real estate within your retirement plans, all the expenses have to come out of that account. So when you're making your mortgage payment, it has to come out of the account. When you're paying your real estate taxes, your insurance, it has to come out of that plan. Same with any improvements. So if you improve the property, new roof, leaky faucet needs to be replaced, has to come out of the account. So reserves are important. When you close on this type of transaction, as the lender, we want to make sure that you have enough emergency funds because things do come up. And if you don't set yourself up initially, it could cause some issues down the road.
Yeah, and please let me interject this. I know many of our listeners are going, 40% down, what the heck? Mm-hmm. I don't want to do 40% down. But folks, there's good and bad here. Even though it's a higher down payment, here's the cool part. Your credit doesn't matter, and your personal dollars aren't on the table. This is your IRA. This is your 401k. So if you've got 50 grand in an IRA, you may say, well, that's not enough to buy a rental. Well, keep in mind that 50 grand could turn into 100 grand with a non-recourse loan, and all of a sudden you're into a whole different pool of assets out there that your IRA could buy. And with putting 40 to 50% down, the likelihood, darn it, should be that you're going to be cash flowing right from day one. You're going to have a little bit of a reserve there, and it's going to be allow your IRA to get a much bigger rate of return. Very doable, and it don't feel bad about the large payment down. That could actually work to you. Now, Matt, one of the, of course, the key questions is, what are the interest rates that someone's going to pay to do this type of project?
Sure, and right now our current rates are going to be mid 4% to low 6%, depending on the product. You know, we offer a 3-5 year ARM. We also offer a 10, 15, 20, 25-year fix. So, the rates are still very competitive. They're not hard money rates. You can still, find something like I mentioned in the high fours, low fives, most definitely. And that's been the case for the last 8 to 12 months right now.
Yeah, but Matt, I have terrible credit.
Credit doesn't matter.
okay. By the way, folks, I wasn't saying that on my personal level. I was using that as an example. Matt, I have terrible credit. You're going to give me a 5% loan and I have bad credit? Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, that's the case. We don't look at credit, so it's strictly based on the property, the cash flow, and then the IRA account. So if you have a 600 credit score or an 800 credit score, that's irrelevant as far as the rate you're going to get. And I mentioned earlier a non-recourse loan, and some of you might have picked up on that and wondered, what is a non-recourse loan? It's one where the IRA account holder or the IRA itself the lender has no recourse. There's no personal guarantee by the IRA. So if the property goes into foreclosure, the lender can only take back the property and sell it. And if they can't recover their losses, lender's out of luck. So because it's non-recourse, we don't look at the individual. We don't look at your employment, your income, and your credit score, as Mark mentioned. So that's another benefit of this type of transaction. If you have poor credit, you don't have a lot of cash, you can use your retirement plan.
I love it. Well, in summary here, I know, Matt, that you're on a tight schedule too, and I appreciate you coming on. I just want to throw out this little point because many of you that have researched this issue are going to think of what's called UDFI, or unrelated debt financed income, a type of tax that could apply when you borrow. But folks, keep in mind, UDFI does not apply to a 401k. So for many of our clients that are trying to use an IRA to buy real estate and they have any sort of small business, we'll convert that IRA over to a 401k and then do the same deal but under a 401k structure and pay no potential tax whatsoever. So very, very exciting. So consider that, folks, for those who have done a little bit of research. Matt, thank you so much for coming onto the show. I know that you may need to run, so I'm going to. You're welcome to stay on and maybe make a comment here when I bring up my other two panelists. But thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Mark. I really appreciate it.
You're awesome. Thank you. Well, okay. Now, our two other panelists here that have I was able to schedule out a little further so that we had more time to spend with them, and I'm so grateful to have them here on the show. We've got Randy Lupke, who's been a guest here on the show before, a registered financial consultant, mortgage advisor, real estate broker, and mortgage broker. He's been working in the financial industry and financial services industry for 25 years. He's here in Newport Beach, California. And just, again, a pleasure to always speak with. So, Randy, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Mark. How are you?
Good. Thank you for being with us. And also, I'd like to bring out Aaron Chapman, a licensed mortgage originator at Cherry Creek Mortgage out of Tempe, Arizona, a 17-year veteran in the finance industry, focusing on investment property financing specifically, and has helped, many of our clients, and has a great reputation as well. And so we're also grateful to have him on the show. Well, Aaron, welcome.
Thank you, Mark. How are you doing today?
Good, good. Well, and I, as I mentioned earlier on, we're so I'm thrilled to have this opportunity to ask you guys some questions, and it's just I don't even know where to start. Sometimes it's so hard, and I guess Randy, I'll start with you for just a quick question. Is it really that hard to get loans today for rental property? is it just knowing where to go? What's the problem here?
I think that's well put. Yeah, it's knowing where to go, and certainly it's getting a little better today than it was, say, a year ago and the year before that. And then it depends again on what type of financing you're getting. If you're looking for financing that's conventional loans through Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, then the guidelines are going to be pretty strict and pretty tight. And if you're looking for alternative financing, then you can get outside those guidelines and have a little more flexibility.
Well, and I'm going to mention it quickly now. I should have already said this, but folks, if you would like to call in and ask these gentlemen a question, please do so at 646-200-4285. I also take live email questions here, and I've already got a couple, some regular listeners that know that I'm watching my email. So, folks, if you want to send in an email, it's Mark, M-A-R-K, at markjkohler.com. We'd love to hear from you. So, Aaron, are you still finding loans for borrowers in real estate? Is there really a dearth out there, or is it doable?
If I couldn't find them, I'd be starving, just because that's really all we're dealing with as investors at this point. Because it's been a focus of mine since 2003, and it really hasn't slowed down that much.
Wow, exciting. Okay, well, here's one of the key questions that I've been wanting to ask. And folks, I know that many of you probably share this same question. So, Aaron, let me ask you first. So is it really something that I have to do? Do I need to go through an application in my own name through a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac product, close on the loan, and then deed my property over to my LLC? Is that the best way to approach an investment property, the only way to approach? What's your response to a question like that?
Typically, when somebody asks you that, I tell them you're going to need to talk to your accountant or your attorney about how to approach that particular type of thing, but there is items within the paperwork the majority of the time that would potentially cause some penalty to you if you transfer the property outside of your name, if you're financing it in your name. So I don't give them any legal advice with respect to that, other than point them to that document that could put them in a potentially difficult scenario down the road.
Right. Okay. Now, is that and we advise clients on a regular basis that the due-on-sale clause is very rarely implemented, and as long as people are paying their loans, and there's oftentimes exemptions for a transfer to your own trust or your own LLC. But irrespective of that, so let's not worry about the due-on-sale clause here. We can bring that up later in our show if someone really wants to get into it. But I guess, Aaron, when I'm out there trying to buy real estate, do I have to start with that strategy? Do I need to buy in a Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac process? Is that the best way to go from your experience? What, do you advise clients to go that route?
I definitely do, because you're going to get your best rates, your best options, best as far as down payment is concerned by going with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac products, because that's what's going to probably fuel their little business easier as they're building up their cash flow, building up their little empire. Then they can start looking at all the other different options out there once they've done that, at least what I've seen with my clients and what they've done over the years, and be able to expand themselves into bigger things that are not that they can afford to do.
Randy, what do you think? And this 10 limit, you know, everybody hears about this. I can only have 10 loans and this Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac process. Is that something you recommend?
Well, yeah, you know, I agree 100% with Aaron. You know, these Fannie Mae, we call them conventional loans, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That financing is the gold standard of the industry today. You're going to get the best terms. You're going to get rates fixed for potentially 30 years at historically low rates. And so as an investor, you want to soak up all of those that you're allowed to soak up. And so to answer the second part of your question, you're limited to 10 financed properties, including your primary residence. And if you strategically work it out, you could actually, if you're married, get that up to a total of 20 properties with loans on it. Proper credit, good income, and cash reserves to support it. But, I agree with Aaron 100%.
Now, Randy, what are in these conventional loans? Now, folks, by the way, I want to take a quick step back here and and I know Aaron and Randy work with these types of real estate educators too. Is there certainly creative acquisition strategies? And folks, we're never going to take away from that. We know that you might look for seller financing or subject to strategies. That's fine. That's the topic for another day. And folks out there that have more than 20 properties, obviously they're going to be getting into more creative acquisition strategies, even joint venturing with others to tap into their credit resources. So, you know, separate from that, there is going to be that pool or that little bundle of real estate that we have in our own name or our own LLC that we've qualified for, and that's good. That's a good thing. So, folks, again, I want to dispel any concerns you might have I don't worry about conventional loans. But conventional loans are an important part of many people's portfolios. I mean, Randy, people are still using conventional lending every day because it works, and they're great rates, right?
Every day, all day. Again, you just have to be able to fit inside the box, the guideline box. And if you fit in, you'll get a loan. If you don't fit in, there's really no flexibility today. So if you want to go beyond that, that's where you need to start looking at portfolio-type lenders or commercial loans, hard money loans, those different categories of lenders.
Okay, now before we get into that, before we get into commercial or portfolio lending, Randy, real quick, what's that credit score look like? How does someone generally fit in that box? It's based on the type of property you're trying to buy too. It's that equation, if you will.
It's based on the type of property you're trying to buy and how many other loans you have. And lenders, for example, Aaron works for Cherry Creek, which is a mortgage banker. Every lender is going to have their own potential overlays that go on top of that credit overlay. So one lender may be willing to make a loan with a 620 mid-credit score. Others may require, 660 or 680 before they're going to consider that. And by the way, remember, we're looking at the middle credit score, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion, if there's two borrowers, husband and wife, we're going to take the lowest middle credit score between the two borrowers.
Now, Aaron, what's your experience from fitting into that box? How do I fit into that box when it comes to credit score and overlays? What's your take on that?
Well, again, credit score-wise, what we're really focusing on is sort of the box is a little bit broader than one can really state for one individual. But they do like to see those high sixes and anything in the sevens is what they really like. But what the main difference is when you're talking about those credit score boxes, anything below that, if you get below the 680s, you're probably not going to see any lending capability. You have to work with someone to bring that up. But the big thing you're going to start seeing, anything below 740, you're going to start seeing a little bit of an adjustment to the expense associated with the rate or an adjustment to the rate itself. So that's the big focus there when it comes to that credit score box. So if we're above that 680, we should be able to make something else work, or at least on the credit side. Then we have to look at all the rest of the person's financial profile and see what we can make fit in the rest of the box.
Okay. And again, I want to come to, you know, borrowing in the name of my LLC directly and trying to expand my portfolio without having these loans show up on my credit. And I want to talk about that in a moment, but you brought up a key word here, rates. And I've got an email here from one of our listeners, Eric. He said, what are you guys seeing for current rates right now? They always seem to be fluctuating. What's the market telling us right now? So, Aaron, what are you seeing?
Right now, as far as in the last week or so, I've been seeing ranges anywhere in the mid-4s up into the low-5, depending upon what program they choose. You know, we're talking about the ARMs or the fixed. 99% of them choose the fixed just because it makes sense. At least that's the strategy that they've been following. And you're talking about low-5s. And say, historically, you can't beat it.
Okay. And I've got another question here from Tina. She says, what's the down payment requirements with these loans typically? Randy, you both commented that high 600 FICO scores are going to be at a bare minimum. You need to really be in the 700s to probably get the type of loan packages you want. How much money down are people going to have to put to get into these conventional loans?
Okay, so for the first four properties, for the first four loans, you can put as little as 20% down. Once you get over that, typically you're going to be required to put 25% and in some instances up to 30% down. And this, by the way, is also a function of your credit score. You know, you asked about interest rate a moment ago, Mark, and interest rate is really a formula which is based on the type of property you're buying. It's based on the points or that you end up paying. It's based on your credit score. It's based on the loan to value. And all those things put together are going to determine your credit score, which is why we have to quote in a range that we'll be looking at.
Okay. So, all right. So I've got to ask it in this way, because I know that this may be very simple for you gentlemen, because you deal in this area every day. Let's say we've got your typical small business owner or maybe even a husband and wife with both day jobs and a little corporate America situation. They've got two W-2s. Their credit scores are pretty strong, you know, maybe let's say high sixes or low sevens, and they're plugging along. So they're credit worthy. You know, Aaron, how many properties would you see that couple be able to purchase? And would they? And I need to ask too, would they purchase maybe three or four in the husband's name alone, and then turn around and apply for three or four more loans in the wife's name? How do you take that brand new couple and build a portfolio of real estate with conventional loans? What would that look like to you?
Well, typically, it's I'll interview them, kind of figure out what their long-term strategy is, and once we're down there. I have a lot of clients right now that have that exact same scenario, very similar, that they're doing multiples in each other's names, and we'll shoot for those first four as quickly as possible, because when we're qualifying a person in those first four finance properties, guidelines are a lot looser. They give you a lot more flexibility in the sense that I can calculate potential rents to the benefit of at least contributing towards their debt-to-income ratio, bringing that down and making them eligible for that first four. Once we start taking that bridge, of four to three, going from five on up, that's when you need to have that history of ownership. It'll count the rents in your favor. If we don't have that history, the individual has to qualify with their total income to be able to support all those debts, not considering any rental income in that. So that's where that becomes a rub, is when you start getting past the four. But in that first four, we take them both and work together and getting them their first four finance properties. They have eight to work with. They're building their oil empire slowly, and they can manage that fairly easily.
Okay, so we have this, and this has been great information for me. You've kind of got this first four tier, and then you can go up to 10. Randy, what do you see for a young or old couple? No, age shouldn't matter here, but a couple that's trying to build a little real estate portfolio. How do they go about it? Like, say you meet with that, you and I have done this together even. We'll have a conversation with a client, and they're like, hey, I want to diversify my portfolio a little bit. I'd like to have some rental properties. How do you recommend they get started, and what type of loans they should look for?
Sure. Well, to start with, in an ideal situation, I would like to try and refinance their current primary residence into just one of their names. So either the husband qualify for that loan, or the wife. But in doing that, that's going to allow us to get that one person completely free of all mortgages, and the other person would then have that primary residence. And the reason we want to do that is it's going to allow me to get more loans, right? If everything's done jointly, both husband and wife on the primary and both husband and wife on all these acquisition of rental properties, they're going to be limited to 10 loans. But if we can do it separately, that's how we can get up to 20. Now, the good news, the very good news about the last few years is people have been acquiring these rental properties is almost every time, in fact, in my examples, every time people acquire a property, it's a positive cash flow. And I don't mean it just covers the mortgage payment. It covers the principal, interest, taxes, insurance, and vacancy, and maintenance, and management fees. So literally, every time we buy a property, it's adding to the income of the borrower. And so it's really not becoming a problem in terms of qualifying for income once we, especially if we get rid of the primary residence. That gets better and better with every house we purchase and finance.
I like it. So me going out buying crappy rental property doesn't help the equation. I need to be buying good properties, obviously. This is good.
Well, you need to buy good cash flow properties, right?
Good cash flow properties, right. Okay, so let's talk. Okay, so once a borrower has 4 to 10 properties, maybe it's a husband-wife scenario, maybe they're single, they've got these 4 to 10 properties, and they're saying, you know what, I want more properties. I want to expand. And we just heard from Matt Allen talking about using IRAs and 401ks, great, non-recourse loans, kind of their own little type of loan. Where do we go next? Like, say my clients show up and this happens all the time, they say, well, Mark, I want to just get the loan in the name of my LLC. I'll still guarantee it so I can get the loan, but I don't want it to show up on my FICO score. I just want it to be more of a quote-unquote commercial loan. Is that what they call them?
Yeah, this is where we transition into portfolio and commercial lending, because both those types of resources will allow loans to be made directly to an entity, to the LLC or the corporation. But one caveat I want to make sure that everybody understands, that just because I have a commercial loan that's not showing up on my personal credit report, right, because it's a commercial loan, the lender is going to ask you in a statement, do you have any other debts that's not showing on your credit report? And you need to tell them if you do, because if you don't disclose debts that you actually have, whether it's private money loans or commercial loans, that would be fraudulent, and you can't do that on any loan application. That make sense?
Well, does that hurt you for your 20 loan scenario? Does it hurt you, or you're just saying you got to talk about it? And a commercial lender, they're going to be more sophisticated. They're going to be adding back all the cash flow from your properties. Is it really just a check the box process, or could it really have detrimental effect?
Well, it depends on which side of the fence we're looking from. So if I'm the conventional lender, I'm going to hold you to, you can have 10 to 20 loans. And those commercial loans are going to count if they're financing properties that are less than 4 units. So if I'm financing properties that are apartment size, 5 units or more, then I won't count them. I need to know about them. But if I'm financing properties that are singles, duplexes, triplexes, or fourplexes, even though commercial loans and even though they're not on your credit report, they will count towards that 10 to 20 loan limit.
Aaron, what are your thoughts on commercial loans? Do you recommend folks to make that transition to a commercial loan? And how do they build a larger portfolio and not be held back from this lending problem?
I definitely recommend that, because, well, I've seen a lot of my clients do that. What I've seen people do and be successful with is, although they may keep the conventional loans that they get in their personal name, when they've created their LLC or whatever entity they've created, I've seen many people direct all of their cash flow coming from their property managers to go directly to their company. So if a property manager is collecting rent, they send the checks to their company. The company receives the checks, and the company makes the payments on the debts, although they are holding the loan, the properties personally, and they have the loans personally. So as they're doing that, they're able to show a company that is operating with an income, and they're showing a balance at the end of the year. They're showing activity in this, so they're filing a separate tax return for that company. And what this is some experience that I have witnessed. Then over time, they're able to go out there once they reach that maximum limit with those 10 finance properties. They now have a company that's been operating for a number of years that they go out and get commercial lending with. And they turn around and go back, and they use that to get loans, whether it be credit lines or whatever with their company. And if they see some of these Fannie Mae properties or some of these conventional loans that they have out there that may be low enough where they say, it makes sense on paper for me to pay that off with my commercial loan and have another available in my personal 10 finance properties to be able to go out and buy another one with lower rates and then still be able to cash flow well by paying it off with my commercial loan, I've seen those things work. And we've been able to count these properties that they do get in their commercial loans and keep on the commercial balance sheet and keep on their entity's tax return. We've been able to count those separate as their personal loans, the personal loans that they're paying on. So I've seen a lot of strategies work out well, and that's one of the ones I've seen the best.
Well,
Mark, can I add to that?
Yes, please, Aaron. Yeah.
Yeah, so the looking at it from the commercial side, oftentimes we're able to bundle what would otherwise be, say, five or ten loans on separate properties and bundle them into one loan. So we could have a client who has, 5, 10, 15 conventional loans on 5, 10, 15 residential properties, and then just get one commercial loan and put all of those properties into that one loan. That basically cleans the slate again, so that allows that client to now go out and get another batch of these conventional finance loans, conventional properties.
Exactly. And then they're appearing on their commercial, the tax return for their entity. So we have a separation. There's a wall built between those. So they can go out and buy more personally because they're showing those entities being owned and responsible under the LLC or whatever entity they form.
Well, and just hearing you guys talk like this is just exhilarating because you understand the long-term strategy here. And I hear nightmare stories of clients walking into their local credit union. I'd like a loan. What do I do? What do I fill out? And they fill out their little pad of paper, and they may have totally screwed up their long-term plan with working with a lender that doesn't know what they're doing here. Of course, we see that in a lot of professions, whether they're lenders or CPAs or who knows what, But guys, how do they find someone like you? And I definitely here in the next few moments want to share your individual contact information so that people can get a hold of you. Any thoughts on how to find a good lender? What would you look for? Aaron first, who would you look for if you were out there in the wilderness?
If I was out hunting, I would start, ask them questions whether or not they've done this before. Is this something that they have personally invested in real estate? What kind of successes have they had? What type of client do they deal with typically? Look at how they advertise or who they work with. If you Google them and you see their website is more or their advertising is more geared towards your first-time home buyer or something to that effect, well, that's somebody that may not be familiar with what I would be looking for. The majority of the people I personally deal with are your self-employed borrowers with maybe three or four companies, and they've spent the last 30 years building their financial platform. I've got to spend a week unraveling it. So you've got to find somebody that it's a matter of asking them the right kind of questions to see whether or not they have enough knowledge to dissect a tax return in a way to help you determine how to set your loans up that would benefit your strategy. It's kind of hard to say exactly how to approach that when each person's scenario is so different. There's no two people alike, so to answer that in a way to send everybody off running and hunting and be successful in their hunt, kind of hard to come to a real solid answer for you on that other than just to really dig deep and ask a lot of questions.
That's excellent. Randy, what do you suggest as folks are out shopping?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this Saturday at your Wealth Transformation Workshop, Mark, but, you as a CPA, your job is to help people find all the deductions that they're legally entitled to so they can minimize their income, which therefore minimizes the income taxes they're going to pay. Now, when it comes to the lending side, you need to have somebody that has the experience and knows their way around a tax return and through a tax return, whether it's a corporate return or a partnership return, the schedulees, so that we have the ability to add back in all those expenses that you took out. Because that's the secret for qualifying when you help self-employed people or people that own lots of rental real estate.
It is an art. I love your analogy there. One other question here before maybe some final comments from you guys is a question from Lisa. She emailed in here. What is there problems? I'm trying to rephrase her question here. It was kind of lengthy. The gist of her question is it a problem to be partnering with others where I might be providing the cash and I have a brother, sister, or friend that's providing good credit? Is there any problems with that in the lending process, or is that acceptable? Aaron, your thoughts?
On the lending side, we're going to focus on whether or not just their qualifying capability and getting the loan, the transaction completed and get the end goal accomplished. But just from a personal side and maybe from a side from more of a Randy type of position would be, or their attorney's position, whichever it is, what's the long term there? I mean, there's potential, they may not have there's potential for somebody to get kind of hosed in that scenario, if you will. So it's a matter of really, really shoring up the agreement between both parties, so that way that doesn't come about. Not all you. There's always the potential for something going wrong.
Yeah, and let me just comment from the legal side of this as a lawyer is that whenever you partner with someone, there's got to be a solid partnership agreement, LLC agreement that ultimately is going to hold the property. So setting that aside, but you as a lender. Does that cause a problem for you? Like if I show up and it's me and Tom and I he's got good credit, I got cash, is there going to be a problem with us trying to buy a property together? Do we have to play some smoke and mirrors, or how do we do that?
That can pose a bit of an issue in the sense that the individual who's going on the loan needs to be able to show ownership of the capital that's going to be used to put the down payment. You can't just borrow from another person. You can't. And the reason being, there's two things you can't do. You can't get a gift. You can't borrow from another entity. What we're looking at here, as Randy and I were talking about loan to values, the amount of down payment a person has, minimum 20%, up to 30%, depending upon several different factors. Now, when a person walks in there and they just barely had a deposit of, say, $50,000 into their account, and they're saying, that's the money I was going to use to put on the down payment. Well, where did that money come from? When you start going backwards and you start finding out where the money came from and it turned out to not be theirs, nobody's going to be able to lend those funds because a person has to have skin in the game. Now, when we're talking about their friend giving them money or say we're going to be a partner, that kind of thing, well, if he decides to stop making the payments on this, he's the only one that we have recourse against. And he's not the one who put the money up. So in reality, that individual, at least in the mind of an institution loaning out the money, may not have the emphasis to make the payments as one who put the money up. That's where you get that little bit of a difficulty.
Yeah, it can be a challenge. Hey, Randy, quickly, maybe a comment there, but in fact, before we, and maybe I'll save that for a final comment from you, but Aaron, since we just finished with you for a moment on that point, how do people get a hold of you? And I know you help with people getting loans around the country. What's your contact information, if you don't mind sharing?
Best way to get me is aaronbchapman.com. So www.aaronbchapman.com. That's going to get all my contact information to see everything there is to know about me.
Okay, Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, B as in boy, uh-huh. Chapman. Chapman.
Yep, P as in Paul. There's a lot of people who fit the T in there as in Tom, and that won't quite get you there.
There you go, aaronbchapman.com. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for being with us today. A wonderful insight in a very complex topic. Randy, any final words on that issue of partnering? And also, we need to make sure we get your contact information out there. Maybe share your contact information first here. So I know, again, you're helping with lending around the country, too.
Absolutely. So my phone number is 800-810-1736, 800-810-1736. And my email address is Randy, R-A-N-D-Y, at lifetimeparadigm.com. Lifetime, L-I-F-E-T-I-M-E, and Paradigm is P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M.com. That's my website also. So that'd be my contact information. And then to answer your question, when we're looking at the conventional financing, that's going to be the smallest box. But if we can get you there, you're going to get the best terms, lowest interest rates, and probably lowest cost possible. But when you start bringing in entities, or whether they be IRAs or LLCs or corporations, portfolio lenders and commercial lenders, they do this all day long. This is the world they live in. So bringing in somebody with good credit, bringing in somebody with money, putting them together to form a business and a partnership and get financing all day long. Yes.
Oh, good. I like that. So, yeah, and I'm going to summarize that, Aaron, that if we go conventional route, then we have that problem of the smoke and mirrors and what type of presentation are we making for the borrower. But if we go with more of a commercial route, we might get. So, guys, thank you. Thank you so much for being with me today. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Hey, Mark. Have a good day.
Thank you. And folks, we'll see you next Tuesday for another Mark Kohler Show.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.